Since allegations by Amnesty International and the BC Civil Liberties Association surfaced that Canada has turned a blind eye to reports that Afghanistan prisoners were being tortured after Canadian soldiers surrendered them to local Afghan authorities, a special commons committee has since been trying to unveil the truth of what happened and if there's any credibility on those allegations. This is what we do know. On the one side, we have the Canadian diplomat, Richard Colvin, previous head of the reconstruction team who served 18 months in Afghanistan, claiming since arriving in Afghanistan in April 2006 to the end of his posting in October of 2007, he repeatedly warned his supervisors in Afghanistan and in Ottawa by way of written reports via the Foreign Affairs Reporting System that prisoners were being tortured in Afghanistan jails by local authorities. Yet Canadian soldiers continued to transfer them over nonetheless. He claims that prisoners were beaten with power cables, given electric shocks, and sleep deprivation. And this continued on for another year because there was no process of first-hand prisoner detainee monitoring at that time, until the process of the transfer of Afghanistan prisoners changed in May 3, 2007, when credible evidence of torture was found. Listen to what Richard Colvin has to say about the events in Afghanistan at the committee of who knew what and when.
The most common forms of torture were beatings, whipping with power cables, and the use of electricity. Also common was sleep deprivation, use of temperature extremes, the use of knives and open flames, and sexual abuse, that is, rape. Torture might be limited to the first days, or it could go on for months. According to our information, the likelihood is that all the Afghans we handed over were tortured. For interrogators in Kandahar, it was a standard operating procedure. A fourth difference between us and the British and Dutch was our unusually poor record-keeping. This had serious consequences. When the Red Cross was finally informed that we had transferred a detainee, not only had a lot of time passed, but the information the Canadian forces had taken was so limited that the Red Cross was often unable even to locate our detainees. Another consequence was that we ourselves did not know about the fate of a given detainee after transfer. Was he still in detention? Had he been released? Had he been transferred to a third party? Had he died under torture or been executed? We had no idea. Once Canada did sign a new memorandum of understanding on 3rd May 2007, we tried to go back to figure out what had happened to the large number of Afghans we had already transferred. However, our records were so poor that the task was physically impossible. Excuse me. I'll offer a concrete example. In June 2006, an Afghan woman came to the PRT in Kandahar. She had three young children with her, including an infant of 6 or 8 months who was listless and visibly sick. The woman's name was Fatima. It was, in my view, an act of considerable courage for her to pass through checkpoints to a heavily fortified compound to talk to a foreigner. Her husband, Bismillah, was a taxi driver. One day he had gone to work but had never come home. Fatima came to the PRT to ask if Canada had detained him. I tried to answer her question, but Canadian records were so hopeless that I was unable to. The final difference, which is a very important one, is that Canada, unlike the UK and Netherlands, cloaked our detainee practices in extreme secrecy. The Dutch government immediately informed the Dutch parliament as soon as a detainee had been taken. The Dutch also provided their parliament with extremely detailed reporting on every stage of detention and transfer, and on the results of monitoring after transfer. The UK has also announced publicly the number of their detainees. The Canadian forces, by contrast, refused to reveal even the number of detainees they have taken, claiming this would violate operational security. When the Red Cross wanted to engage on detainee issues, for 3 months the Canadian forces in Kandahar wouldn't even take their phone calls. The same thing happened to the NATO ISAF command in Kabul, who had responsibilities to report detainee numbers to Brussels, but were told, "We know what you want, but we won't tell you." Frankly, the operational security argument makes no sense to me. If we go into a village and take away three Afghans, everyone in the village knows exactly who we have taken. In practice, the information was being concealed, not from the Taliban, but from NATO ISAF, the Red Cross, and the Canadian public. To recap, Canada took far more detainees than the British and Dutch. Unlike our NATO allies, we conducted no monitoring. Instead of hours, we took days, weeks, or months to notify the Red Cross, which meant nobody else could monitor. We kept hopeless records, and apparently to prevent any scrutiny, the Canadian forces leadership concealed all this behind walls of secrecy. As I learned more about our detainee practices, I came to the conclusion that they were contrary to Canada's values, contrary to Canada's interests, contrary to Canada's official policies, and also contrary to international law. That is, they were un-Canadian, counterproductive, and probably illegal. Starting in May 2006, as we in the field became aware of the scope and severity of these problems, we began informing Ottawa about them. We used the means available to us, that is, written reports and verbal briefings, to alert senior officials in both DFAT and the Canadian Forces about the grave deficiencies of our detainee practices and their grave consequences. It was our function, responsibility, and obligation to provide such information and analysis. That was our job. The concerns we expressed, I believe, reflect mainstream views and values in both DFAT and the Canadian Forces. I know that my closest military colleagues in Kandahar were extremely troubled by what we were doing with detainees. We on the ground in Kandahar, civilians and military, informed DFAT and the senior military leadership about the notification problems to the Red Cross, the delays and the inadequate information. We informed them about our very serious concerns about what was happening to detainees after transfer. We informed them about the lack of information being given to NATO. In our annual human rights report at the end of 2006, we informed them about systemic problems of torture in Afghan jails. By March 2007, we were orally warning Ottawa that the NDS tortures people, and if we don't want our detainees tortured, we shouldn't hand them to the NDS. And on April 24th and 25th, 2007, as the detainee issue was becoming a political crisis in Ottawa, the embassy sent two reports that offered Ottawa a solution. To protect our detainees from being tortured, we should adopt the British and Dutch approach, that is, take responsibility for our own detainees, monitor them ourselves, and establish a robust, aggressive, and well-resourced monitoring mechanism that would guard our detainees from further risk of abuse. Senior officials in DFAT and the Canadian Forces did not welcome our reports or advice. At first, we were mostly ignored. However, by April 2007, we were receiving written messages from a senior Canadian government coordinator for Afghanistan to the effect that we should be quiet and do what we were told, and also phone messages from a DFAT assistant deputy minister suggesting that in the future, we should not put things on paper, but instead use the telephone.
Then on the other side, we have the Canadian government trying to discredit and dismiss allegations from Richard Colvin. The Defense Minister, Peter MacKay, and the Prime Minister have denied seeing any of Richard Colvin's reports. Peter MacKay stated that his allegations are nothing short of hearsay, second or third-hand information, or it came directly from the Taliban, which in essence means that they are not credible. We also have the current Foreign Affairs Minister, Lawrence Cannon, and the previous Defense Minister and Deputy Foreign Minister, Gordon O'Connor and David Mulroney, also denying that Canadian soldiers knowingly handed over prisoners who were later tortured. So who are we to believe? Before, the Canadian government had said that we had not received any credible reports of torture. But when a high-ranking Canadian diplomat reports that there is torture taking place, then the Canadian government changes its stance and states that there is no proven reports of torture. So which is more important, a credible report or a proven allegation? Who is credible, Richard Colvin or the Canadian government? We have both sides pointing fingers at who knew what and when. How far in the government did they know about it, and why wasn't anything done about it? We know this, it's a lot more complicated than meets the eye, and we know that somebody is definitely not telling the truth. As the Special Commons Committee continues, it definitely seems that a full public inquiry must take place so the truth can be found. Stay tuned.